So, I'm just going to provide, just to let you know, a bit of a roadmap of where we're going. I'm going to provide a bit of an overview of our faithful advocacy work and how we land on the issues that we come to. And then we're going to spend a bulk of our time sharing about our current work. So we have four current campaigns that we're going to talk about. Today is a bit more of a presentation style than some of our past days. Which isn't our favorite. So please do interrupt us, right? We don't want to just talk at you, we want to talk with you. So if you want to know more about something, feel free to raise a hand, chime in, and we can definitely make space for that because we want you to get the most out of this time together. Okay, so Earth Ministry works on a spread of campaigns. Currently, we are involved in efforts around climate justice work. Much of that is in the state legislature. So Washington State's legislative session is in the beginning of the year, starts in January, goes till March or April, May, depending on the year. We alternate between a short and long session, so there are different amounts of time each year. So climate justice, fossil fuels, which generally looks like halting fossil fuel mega projects. So proposals have been popping up over the last decade along the West Coast for facilities like coal export terminals, oil by rail facilities, and now the big thing is fracked gas, which you may think of as natural gas. Please, if you take anything away from this, it is, don't say natural gas, call it fracked. Reality is that the gas that we get from, you know, our stoves, etc., is fracked. And the term natural gas is very much a greenwashing effort by the fossil fuel industry. They've done really interesting messaging studies where they like ask the person, what do you feel about natural gas? And they're like, it's clean, it's good. What do you feel about fracked gas? It's dirty, it's bad. Did you know they're the same thing? What? So, fracked gas is a term that we are really trying to spread out there. Much of the work around fossil fuel facilities, unfortunately, has ended up in solidarity with Native Nations because their land and waters are sacrificed first and foremost as an ongoing product of colonialization and white supremacy, right? So we have worked with Lummi Nation up near Bellingham at the northwest corner of Washington to stop what would have been the world's largest coal export terminal there. We've actually stopped all of the coal export terminals that have been proposed, which is amazing and really awesome work. We have worked with the Quinault tribe out on the coast of Washington to stop oil by rail facilities. And we're now standing in solidarity with the Puyallup tribe in Tacoma, where there is a fracked gas plant that has been built on their ancestral lands and water without their consent.
Were you able to connect with the Cowlitz tribe when you referenced Kalama and Longview?
We didn't do as much, but yeah, they were involved. So pretty much, I mean, we know indigenous peoples are everywhere, right? So, and different tribes have different relationships with fossil fuels, especially with coal. There was, you know, some interesting conflicting views intertribally. So, yeah, really important to do that work to connect, especially when the tribe has outspokenly taken a stance. Earth Ministry personally didn't do quite as much with Cowlitz. Okay, so we've got climate justice, we've got fossil fuels. I wrote climate twice on my list. But the other work that we do often with tribal nations is salmon and orca recovery. So we're doing a lot of this currently with the Nimapu or Nez Perce tribe in southeast Washington around the Lower Snake River, and we'll talk more about that. But of course, our treaties are the supreme law of the land in they're very much government-to-government promises and have not been upheld. So That is a moral issue of the utmost concern for us. And, abundant salmon runs are more than a treaty protected resource. They are a relative to Native peoples. They are a cultural cornerstone to the way of life that has been happening since time immemorial. So that is really important to us, as is the work around Southern resident orca recovery. There's a current effort to bring home a whale that has been held in captivity in the Seaquarium, like SeaWorld, in Miami. And that's some of our current campaigns too. I don't know if we'll have time to get there quite as much today, but Scalachuctanut is that whale that is really seen as a relative to Lummi Nation, and they've been doing a lot of work to advocate for bringing her home from the really terrible conditions she's held in.
How long has she been in captivity?
Since 1970. Wow. She was taken as a baby from the Salish Sea. Her mother is still
Her mother, Ocean's Son, is still swimming around the Salish Sea, and when people play like recordings of her family, she recognizes
it. She knows her mom's song.
Oh my gosh, we could really get into this. I don't think we have time today. But I will say there's going to be a virtual event live streamed to Earth Ministries Facebook page this Sunday, August 8th at 4 p.m. Pacific time. That's about Scalachuctanut, and there's some Lummi elders that are leading this campaign to bring her back to the Salish Sea in a sanctuary type environment off of Lummi land. So yeah, could learn, lots to learn there.
Yeah, if you're heading home tomorrow, once you get back to the world of Wi-Fi, we encourage you to tune in on Sunday to learn more on that. Really like heart-wrenching situation. Okay, so we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. Going back to kind of our overall issue areas. So we've got climate justice, fossil fuels, salmon and orca recovery. And then the fourth area is toxic chemical reform. So this is looking at the products that are in our homes and our communities, and we come in, encounter them every day. And unfortunately, the chemical industry has gotten away with self-regulating for far too long. And self-regulating means not regulating, right? So currently we are working on a class of chemicals called PFAS. They are non-stick chemicals. Think like Teflon and Gore-Tex. They're incredibly pervasive. They call them forever chemicals because they never really break down. And we have, done a fair amount of work on this. We've had some success in passing a bill that is phasing out PFAS in food packaging, like popcorn bags, pizza boxes, etc. But there's still much more to do. So our work on toxic chemical reform is a really different entry point into our environmental advocacy work. It's often something where we can find common ground and folks can start to engage that might not think of themselves as your classic environmentalist, but no one wants to poison their kids, right? So I think that that's a campaign area that can really bring people together. Like, it's rare that you see, like, I don't know, the Catholic Conference and the Unitarians and Quakers all coming together in the state legislature around a bill, right? And so this is one of those that can do that. It's not that rare, but you get what I mean. Okay, I do want to say a bit about how we come to these campaigns, how we decide what we're engaging on as the Earth Ministry community. I mentioned that our work is often in solidarity with tribes. That's really important to us. And so when something comes up and there's a request for assistance from tribes, we respond to that as much as we can, right? Because we think that that is really our obligation and our duty as good allies. When we do that, we're really intentional to stand behind the tribal leadership. So strategy is directed by tribal council or activists, and we show up to support in a supporting role, which is really important as a practice of of good allyship and, you know, undoing, not undoing, but acknowledging the past of genocide by the Christian community especially. So we're mindful of that. And sometimes, you know, it takes us in a really interesting direction. So, for example, when we started on the work with Coal Export, Lemmy said, oh, we want to carve a totem pole and take it from place to place and fill it with prayers and blessings. And now we've done that for, gosh, 9 years in a row, I think. And it's become really a journey that is known and followed. But at the beginning, it was like, I don't know, like, can we have this event at a church? And so Earth Ministry would do that organizing, and then now it's kind of like, oh, don't worry, we cold called some Catholics in Portland and we got it set up, right? So it's an interesting example of the steps towards reconciliation and rebuilding trust that can happen when you show up to follow the lead of the Indigenous activists. And honor the strategy that they set forth. Then we also work with secular campaign partners. So we really value collaboration as a core value. And so we are in a variety of coalition spaces with groups that you might recognize like Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, Climate Solutions, etc. So these are the generally larger nonprofits that have staff that are focused in on policy, on science, on economics, and have that expertise to bring in to share within coalitions. And then we show up and are really mindful of where does it make the most sense for the faith community to step in here and to kind of translate the information into more faith-based values-rooted language. So just to say that we are part of the overall environmental justice movement in our state. We really want to be strategic with what we engage in and aligned with the broader movement and show up uniquely ourselves to bring our moral grounding. Okay, I'm going to pause there and see if we have questions about how we go about our advocacy before we get into more specifics about what the current campaigns we are working on look like. Yeah?
How big is the Earth Ministries team, and like how many connected faith traditions or churches or, you know, are you working with?
Yeah, so our team is small but mighty. Currently three of us.
Cool.
We are actually in the process of hiring an additional teammate for part-time multi-faith outreach coordinator. So if you know anyone, the application is still open. In terms of our network, Maddie can speak more to that because you're in the database more often than I am. But it's a good spread. I will say in full transparency, Earth Ministry started about 30 years ago out of the Christian tradition. I'll say that we're very ecumenical in our Christian community, and we are increasingly leaning into a multi-faith identity. We have been doing work within the interfaith community for over a decade, but it is recent as of our new strategic plan released last year that Earth Ministry has committed to being a fully multi-faith organization, meaning on all levels. So we've welcomed our first Jewish and Unitarian board members. We've changed our logo so that it doesn't have a cross in it, and are doing more intentional outreach into faith communities outside of the Christian tradition. But I'd say our base is still primarily rooted in Protestant, Catholic. We have a fair amount of Unitarian participation, and increasingly Jewish communities that we're working with. Do you have any, I don't know where our numbers are currently.
Yeah, our email list right now is about reaches almost 6,000 people. That's nationwide, because Earth Ministry started out as we were one of the first faith-based environmental nonprofits, and so we had folks from all over the country. Our Yeah, I wish I had the number of congregations off the top of my head, but.
Also, we have a bit over 60 greeting congregations, which are the most engaged. I think it might be around 200 total houses of worship, maybe more. Relatively out there. I will say the communities that we work with are primarily those who are wanting to engage but might not know how to go about it. So we're not really in the business of showing up and convincing anyone that climate change is real, because ain't nobody got time for that, right? But more trying to help folks that want to engage navigate how they can most effectively do that. Yeah.
How do you decide your priorities? Because I'm sure that there's a lot to think about at any given time, and y'all only have so many people and firepower.
Yeah, so that's why we are working within these four issue areas currently. We definitely get asked to participate in other issues like pesticides and ag issues, right, is one that will come up fairly often.
Or Hanford remediation.
Yeah, or the nuclear plant, Hanford, and its toxic waste issues. So it's hard to have to say no to things that certainly matter. I find peace with it, with knowing that there are really awesome organizers working across the spectrum of issues. But for us, these four issue areas are what we've seen interest bubbling up around within our community, and people have been relatively formed in these areas. So when we talk about toxic chemicals, you know, it's an issue we've worked on for a decade, so people understand, oh yeah, we really need more comprehensive chemical safety policies because we've done that groundwork education. In terms of timing, democracy is a year-round process, right? So it can all hit at the same time, which can be a bit of a roller coaster, but a lot of our timing is determined by when public comment periods drop and things like that. Seasons that are especially busy, like the legislative session, like election time. I will say we're a 501c3 nonprofit, as are all of your houses of worship. So we can engage in supporting ballot measures and initiatives. We cannot do any candidate endorsement. So that's where the line is drawn. We can support policies, not people. That said, you can host like candidate forums on climate justice, as long as you invite all of the candidates and follow bipartisan rules. So, yeah, does that help? Mm-hmm. Other questions?
I was sort of curious. I'm new to most of it, but following some of the conversations for like the movement for Black Lives put out a whole climate justice mm-hmm. platform, and kind of all the intersections around. You know, you have talked a lot about this with coming alongside and accompanying indigenous tribes. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of curious from like the Black liberation standpoint, if there's been conversations with Earth Ministries about how all of that stuff is tied up, right? And capitalism and white supremacy and all of it together. So I'm mm-hmm. just curious if you have any thoughts from what you've done.
Yes. So that is something we're really leaning into in terms of coming alongside, as you called it. So we just released a JEDI statement, which is justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. Often it's called DEI, just diversity, equity, inclusion. The JEDI movement is actually led by Black clergy from the Southeast who say, you know, DEI is great, but really you gotta do justice first. So this justice first movement is something that we're aware of through our connections with the national IPL community, Interfaith Power and Light. I've mentioned that a couple times. We're the Washington State organization represented within that network. So that's what I'm talking about with IPL. There's 40 states about, so that have one. We're also part of the US Climate Action Network, which is engaged in the Justice First movement. So our JEDI statement is relatively new, and it's something we're really taking seriously and leaning into. We have a series of commitments that go alongside our statement, so we're not just saying nice words, we're also looking at how we're really putting it into practice and how it can be a lens through which we do all of our work. bringing in, you know, the Black liberation movement is something that we are really mindful of and want to do in a way that's authentic. So it's really starting, unfortunately, kind of slow in building relationships. Historically, Earth Ministry has, like I said, we work with people who really want to engage. So that's kind of led to a primarily white base because it's people who approach us, and those who approach us have the time and resources to do so. So we're a bit shifting our outreach strategy to be a little bit more proactive and to say, hello, we exist. If you would like to work with us, we would love that. Also, we're not your, if you're not your thing, that's okay. So we're in the stage of early on living into this work and doing more of that outreach within the BIPOC community, but want to be very mindful in how we go about it. I will say that there are, it definitely shows up within our advocacy work. So an example is, this year in the state legislature, there was a bill put forward by the governor and the chairs of the environmental committee for a cap and trade policy. It's a price on carbon. It's been shown to be particularly harmful to overburdened communities elsewhere, especially in California. And so our partners in a coalition called Front and Centered, which is the state's largest coalition of community of color-led organizations, they were really opposed to this bill that the governor put forward. Because from their lived experience, they've seen it not create as much, you know, progress solutions as harm. So Earth Ministry, you know, deviated from many of our coalition partners who ended up supporting that bill, and we decided not to support it and to stand with Front and Centered in their opposition to that policy. We had to do a lot of conversation with our predominantly white, predominantly male, like wonky climate policy guys, right? To explain what that is and why it's rooted in our Jedi statement. And the message that we really kept coming back to is that the climate crisis is a moral crisis, and how we respond to the climate crisis is also a moral issue. So we're not gonna sacrifice communities that are already being sacrificed further. We need to really find solutions that bring all along. And there was a viable solution that was put forward by BIPOC communities that was totally disregarded this session. So unfortunately that bill did pass. So we're now in the kind of reactive phase of looking towards implementation and doing what we can to stand with our partners and minimize harm in how the bill is brought to life.
Can you say a little bit more about what exactly is the harm to BIPOC communities from this bill?
Yeah, from cap and trade in general. So cap and trade commodifies pollution. So polluters are able to, there's a cap that is set of your limit of how much you can pollute. And if you go over that, you have to pay. Fossil fuel companies have a lot of money, so they can pay. There's a whole trading mechanism. You can pay off your pollution. You can buy offsets, but unfortunately those offsets are generally not in the communities where the pollution is happening, which is really the important piece. And so it's a bit like trying to fix the problem with what created the problem, which is the market-driven system. There's a lot of debate around it. It can get, like, we could talk about this for 2 hours, right? But the core of it is that we've seen it really concentrate pollution in already overburdened communities in how it was implemented in California.
So while, like, the whole overall amount of pollution in the state went down, it was actually increased in certain communities, and those communities were often people of color.
So it's increasing these environmental sacrifice zones, which is something that does not align with our values. And I can also direct, there's a lot of good resources out there from Front and Center on this topic. So I would suggest exploring there. Some of it's linked to our ministry's website as well. Yeah, Jesse.
What was the alternative bill that was?
The alternative bill was called Washington Strong, and it was a green bonds policy. Honestly, I don't fully understand the economics of it, but it was something that was much more broadly supported across diverse communities, but then also within rural communities. So it might be something we see come back forward. We'll see down the road. But it basically got blocked by the chair of the Environment Committee. It got one hearing, and then he wouldn't let it move any further because he was sponsoring the other bill. So we put up with a lot of malarkey, right? Which is certainly frustrating at times, and for me is also a reason why I really have to come to this work through my faith. Because when I do so, I bring a different level of hope and resilience and perseverance to the work. I am more frequently reminded that I am not the savior in this situation, right? But we each have gifts that we can bring to allow God to work through us and know that together we can help create this more just society that is what religious traditions across the board call for. Okay, well, I want to be sure we have time to dig in to the good stuff here. So we are going to cover four different campaigns, and we'll pause too so that you can ask more questions. And we'll start with the Clean Cars work, since you heard me perhaps talk about that at worship the other night. So, again, with a bit of backstory in the state legislature this year, we were supporting this bill to set a target for all of vehicles model year 2030 or later to be required to be electric to be registered in Washington State. That got a lot of good traction, actually. It was amended onto a larger electrification package that was calling on utilities to prepare for the reality of increasing transportation electrification. And it passed both chambers, which is great. Unfortunately, throughout the process of its passage, it was added to, and there was an amendment introduced that tied the Clean Cars target to a road usage charge. I don't want to get too wonky here, but the basics are currently Washington State's transportation income comes from a gas tax. So as we transition off of gas, how are we going to have money to keep our infrastructure funded? We also just need a good transportation package, which has been a stalemate for multiple years in the state legislature. But one of the alternatives is a road usage charge, which is more like a mile-based tax to help create that income. It's super controversial and going to take quite some negotiations to iron out. So because that requirement was added to the Clean Cars bill, the governor actually vetoed the Clean Cars section, saying that it's like too important to have tied to this road usage fee conversation. So we can understand that. And now we're like, okay, Governor Inslee, so what are you gonna do about it? So that is why we are doing this push to petition the governor to enact this Clean Cars 2030 standard as an executive order. This is how we saw it come about in California. Their target date is 2035, so we're trying to be a bit more ambitious. But it is 100% doable. So when we did that meditation together on the lawn the other night and imagined that future we want to see, that is, you know, not some fairy tale. That is what we can be living 10 years from now. The technology is there and increasing all the time. The main stumbling block is really the paid for misinformation by the fossil fuel industry. So when you hear these talking points like, oh, but the batteries, right? Like, how long do the what do we do with the batteries when we're done, and how long do they last? EV batteries today are lasting twice as long as the batteries in gas-powered vehicles already, And they are being reused to store energy like at solar farms and whatnot at the end of their life. So they're being repurposed and recycled and are lasting longer. You know, the other point is like, oh, I can't do a cross-country road trip, right? So there is that, there are limits, but if we set this standard, we are going to be committing to this future, right? Which means that infrastructure will grow around that, especially if it's a government-mandated target versus something that the market drives. That's the other talking point against it, is like, oh, we'll reach that anyways. We don't need to force it. Like, we're headed in that direction. Yes, but if it is a target set by Washington State, then there will be more incentives, more investment. It can be more affordable, like there may be rebates to help low-income folks. So it is important to have it be a state-set policy. Yeah.
What work is being done to get more of a network of charging stations set up?
Yeah, so that is the bill that I talked about, that this was a part of, is addressing that. And that did pass, right? That part did not get vetoed. Okay. So that is telling utilities that you need to prepare for this vehicle electrification boom and invest in providing more rapid charging stations, et cetera. So it's kind of a chicken versus the egg situation, but it is something that's being actively pushed
forward. Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
So did the bill that passed also include anything about subsidies for like lower income drivers or?
Yes. So that would be built in here with this. And that's why I'm saying that it's important to have it passed as a state policy, because if it's more market driven, if it's just like, well, we've seen manufacturers promising they're moving to electric anyway, then they don't.
Tesla.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't have those, that accountability to make it affordable, right?
Maybe if you're going to get to this, that's fine. But has Governor Inslee taken a position on whether he would just do this by executive order? And what were his reasons if he said he wasn't interested in doing that?
Yeah, good question. I'm not sure. So this is where, you know, we kind of get the pass along information, because we're not the policy people meeting with the governor's staff. I think that it is very much viable, and if the governor gets enough public backing, it makes them easier to do it. Honestly, the governor is in hot water
He needs a win. This could be the win for him.
Yeah, he pissed off a lot of folks in the environmental community with that bill that I talked about, with the cap and trade, with...
By vetoing it, you mean?
No, by pushing it and passing it.
So he vetoed the Clean Cars bill, passed the cap and trade bill. Both of those things riled up the environmentalists.
Yeah.
And tribes.
And within the cap and trade, he vetoed the piece of the bill on tribal consultation. And the tribes are what really got that bill through. So that was a big stab in the back. So there's a lot of reconciliation that needs to happen between the governor and his office and Native Nations and the environmental community. So I say that all that my inclination is that there's some incentive for him to do something that would bring you back a bit of good graces.
If we write into the governor's attorney bill or anything to reference for him to
do this?
Yes.
So Earth Ministry has our petition, and that is being comboed with coalition partners' petitions. So that is the main thing that's going to be delivered to the governor. We're actually having a big rally about this in Seattle on the 14th. So if you're around and want to hang out, we'll be at St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral, which recently installed their own EV chargers that are dedicated to Earth Ministry's founder, Reverend Jim Mulligan, which I just think is so nice. So, yeah, this is the push right now. And our petition currently just has like your spot for your name to sign on. But if you want to write a more detailed comment, if you do that through Earth Ministries online form, there's a spot for you to write in your comment, and you can share your story a bit more. So I want to back up a little bit, because we are getting a little into the weeds on this conversation. And so that reminds me of a core piece of our faithful advocacy work, which is the beauty that you don't have to know it all to be an advocate. Especially when you're coming to this work as a person of faith, what you have to know is the values that stir up in you your passion and interest in taking action on this, and how you can articulate and share that out. I think a lot of times people say, oh, I can't wade in because I don't know enough about the topic. You know, I'm not an expert on electric vehicles. What if I get asked a question I don't know the answer to? I love when I'm in a meeting and get asked a question I don't know the answer to. Very counterintuitive, but it gives me a chance to say, you know, I don't know. I will get back to you. I'll talk to our partners, or you can say it. I'll talk to Earth Ministry and get back to you on that. But what I do know is that I want to see a future in which my godson grows up and only knows electric vehicles, right? Because we've made this commitment, and the air that he has will be cleaner, the asthma rates will be lower, and we're really committed to the well-being of all. Right, so, yeah. Today we want to provide you with enough information about these campaigns that you feel like a baseline comfort in engaging, but also reassure that you don't have to know it all in order to participate. And even if it's a little bit uncomfortable, I really encourage you to lean in there. And also trust that there are the people who are sending in the really technical comments, who are the economists, the scientists, etc. Like, they are participating too, right? So we are part of that overall effort, and bring a really unique piece in our gift as showing up as people of faith. So we can trust in the work being done by our partners, and also bring what we can bring that is one of a kind. How's that feel? Thumbs up, thumbs up. Okay, so let's move on to our next campaign. Maddie is gonna take us away on the fracked gas work that we're doing.
Yeah, thanks Jess, and feel free to let me wrap it up if I get too passionate.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as Jess mentioned, one of the campaigns we're currently working on in solidarity with the Puyallup tribe is against the Tacoma liquefied natural gas plant that's being built in the Port of Tacoma on the Tacoma Tide Flats, and also on the Puyallup tribe's ancestral lands and waters. So this project started a few years ago. It's being built by Puget Sound Energy, which is a large for-profit utility company on the west side, and then they also, I believe, have a lot of customers in Kittitas County. Who here knows their Puget Sound Energy customer? Yep, lots of folks, I imagine. Me too. Yeah, and so there's been a lot of greenwashing about this project on the part of Puget Sound Energy to say, like, this is actually the clean energy we need. But we're hearing from folks on the front lines of fracking and from the Puyallup tribe that that's not true. It's just not true. And so this plant is pretty large. It's almost all the way constructed in the Tacoma Tide Flats. And there's been a lot of discussion about, okay, is this on the tribe's reservation or not? The Puyallup tribe is a federally recognized tribe and they have a reservation. And that's parts of Tacoma and what's also known as Fife. And the really interesting thing about this project is that the land the plant is being built on was never land when the treaty was signed back in the 1850s between the federal government, the Puyallup tribe, and then this is the Treaty of Medicine Creek, and the Nisqually and Squaxin Island tribes were also signatories. Because the Tacoma Tide Flats, as they're still known, were mud flats that varied with water levels during the tides. And so it's just outside of the boundary of the reservation, but the only reason that's the case is because this wasn't land when the treaty was signed. And so, yeah, there's a lot there in terms of treaty rights and treaty law and the fact that the federal government and state government really haven't ever truly respected or honored treaty rights for tribes in our state, including the Puyallup tribe. However, the way the treaty works is that treaty rights apply outside of a tribe's reservation up to the boundaries of the treaty. So that includes, because it was multiple tribes signing this, it includes really all of what's known today as Commencement Bay and the land that the plant is being built on. And so when tribes signed this treaty, they were guaranteed the right to fish and hunt in their accustomed areas, even if that's outside their reservation. And so, like, the Puyallup tribe leadership and activists have said, this project threatens our treaty rights and salmon populations on the Puyallup River that are already threatened and endangered, really. And a lot of, even though tribal folks have the right to fish and hunt there, a lot of them have stopped fishing because they're worried about the population themselves. And so that's what the Puyallup tribe has said about this project. We're supporting them in those efforts. What Puget Sound Energy wants to do with the Tacoma LNG plant is use the liquefied natural gas to fuel ships, the freight ships that go up to Alaska and back. I won't get into the weeds about greenhouse gas emissions and how it's actually worse because fracking, etc. And I'll talk about where the project is now. So I mentioned this happened a couple years ago. It's almost completely built. The project actually has all of its permits that it needs to operate, but it's not over. It's absolutely not over. And in fact, I was just checking my email like throughout this session to make sure that news about the project hadn't dropped while we were here at Holden. Because what happened is the last permit that Puget Sound Energy got was a clean air permit issued by the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. And after that permit was issued in, December 2019, I think, right before the pandemic, the Puyallup tribe and some environmental partners appealed that permit decision. And those, based on the fact that they thought the greenhouse gas analysis was bad science. And one interesting thing I'll also share is that there was a similar project in Washington, in Southwest Washington, near you all. Some Presbyterian pastors we were talking to earlier that were involved in that fight. This Kalama methanol plant was denied its permit based on bad science, which was the same science used for the Tacoma LNG greenhouse gas analysis, but different agencies issued those permits. So this appeal has, these appeal hearings on this clean air permit took place in April, just a couple months ago. It was heard by a body called the Washington State Pollution Control Hearings Board, which hears appeals to approvals or denials of environmental type permits throughout the state. And it was a 2-week long set of hearings where the Puyallup tribe's lawyers and earth justice lawyers that were representing some of the local environmental groups like really laid out this argument. Not necessarily based on treaty rights, like there's so many things we could talk about that are wrong with this project. And they really focused on the science of analyzing the greenhouse gas emissions. We're expecting a decision on that permit appeal literally any day now. Like, I've been checking my email every day since I got here to see, okay, has the Tacoma LNG decision dropped? Like, we were like, it'll be our luck if it drops while we're here. And that's really exciting because if the body, the Pollution Control Hearings Board, rules in the tribe's favor, that permit, that clean air permit, will be revoked, the plant can't operate, and it will go back to the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. for a new environmental impact statement and public comment opportunities. So we're really hoping that there's going to be an opportunity for the community again to weigh in and say, okay, now that you've actually done the science right on this permit, like, and just to speak about it.
And I'll add that with the Kalama fracked gas facility, it also took 2 rounds. So they also had to do a supplemental environmental review before it was actually denied. So this could follow that win earlier this year was really huge in setting a precedent. And so we're hopeful that they'll do the right thing in response. And then go through it a second time and hopefully end up with a denial.
Yeah, and so while we've been waiting for that appeal decision to be released, obviously there's a lot at stake there, but we also want to make sure we keep, because we're not lawyers, we're not in the court, there's nothing we can really do right now except wait for the decision and get the word out in the court of public opinion. So like the only folks that benefit from people not talking about this are Puget Sound Energy, that's already has a bunch of money to run ads in Tacoma on TV to say, this is like our green jobs, etc. When it would really only support, like, I think less than 20 permanent jobs in the facility. I could talk about this for hours. We also do hour-long workshops on all of these campaigns that Jess and I will be talking about today. Always happy to come rant about Tacoma Energy to your community, especially as we'll probably have some new action steps very soon. One thing I wanted to mention about this specific campaign is there is an Indigenous-led media organization nonprofit called Native Daily Network that has been a major part of documenting all of the issues with Tacoma LNG and this fight as it's taken place over several years. So their website is nativedailynetwork.org. Please go to their website, check it out. They have tons of media coverage of the Puyallup, especially from the Puyallup tribe's perspective of this issue. They also made a feature-long documentary film called Ancestral Waters. You can watch it for free online because they really want as many people to know about this as possible. It's a really, really wonderful, great film. It's also depressing, but there's a lot at stake for the tribe in this fight. We also have been doing screenings of this film, Ancestral Waters, in faith communities on Zoom because of the pandemic. If you're interested in that, please let me know. And go watch the film yourselves online. And if you feel so compelled to donate a little bit to Native Daily Network to support their work, that would be much, much appreciated by them, because they're letting folks watch this film they made and put a lot of resources into for free for the sake of the movement. Yeah, any quick questions about Tacoma LNG? Karen.
I guess this is about that, but also about Puget Sound Energy.
Oh yeah.
Because, you know, as somebody who pays rent and pays for my utilities and my electric bill and all of this, you know, I just want to know, like, that's just a red flag, you know, learning about all of this and about PSE's mm-hmm. role in it. What can I do, if anything? I mean, you say you pay them for your bill, which...
Yeah, no, and especially when customers learn that ratepayers are paying for 40% of this project,
that
literally will only ever, at most, use 2% of the gas, the liquefied natural gas in it. I think lots of people have written to Puget Sound Energy and said, hey, this is really not good. I'll also just say, so you live in Redmond on the east side.
Yeah.
There's currently a campaign or we're not heavily involved in it because we just can't do everything, but there's a campaign for a East King County Public Utility District to sort of break Puget Sound Energy's monopoly. That's a campaign run by 350 Eastside. You could potentially look that up. That's really as much as I know about it.
Yeah. I'll add, if you want to write to PSC, a really excellent starting point that they just gave us is a whole page on their website about their values, and there's like moral, ethical accountability board or something that they've created. Honestly, since this project has started, because we've thrown so much heat and shade at PSC. So I spoke at a press conference about this earlier this year and pulled out some direct quotes from their own website that was like in such direct contradiction to everything they're doing. So it's always good to throw someone's words back at them as a tool for accountability, right? So you can dig that up and send them a note. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Devin. Are the goals that PSC has for fueling ships that are going to Alaska, is that for like new ocean trade, or is it an existing industry that has a different fuel source?
Yeah, currently they have a contract with Tope Maritime, which is a shipping company that operates out of the Port of Tacoma.
Okay.
That currently runs their ships on bunker fuel, mm-hmm. which is also really dirty. I won't get too into the weeds on it, but when scientists have actually looked at all of the emissions that come from the entire process mm-hmm. of getting the fracked gas to Tacoma and then having it burn for fuel in the barges, when you frack, really quickly, when you frack gas, a lot of methane is released, and methane is a super, super potent greenhouse gas. And so if you're doing the science right and looking at it, it's actually worse overall.
Okay, so there is an existing fuel source.
Yes,
but
and
an
I'll
opportunity
say,
for
I'll
something
say that,
different.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say that Tope Maritime, it's not been clear to them that this project is actually going to go through and go online yeah. because of all the resistance. They haven't even converted their ships to run on LNG yet. So, like, this plant, even though Puget Sound Energy has mostly constructed, it's multiple years away still from actually being used. They don't want you to know that, but...
The other really sketchy thing is that the capacity of the plant is far higher than what it would be used for this bunker fuel. So they're mm-hmm. saying it's for bunker fuel and for peak shaving, which is like, you know, if there's a big cold front in the winter and it snows in Tacoma and everyone's using their heater all at the same time on full blast, right? So what's sketchy about that is since it is a higher capacity, once something's built, it's much easier to get a permit to expand to start, maybe exporting.
There's already rumors in Tacoma that they want to expand and they haven't even.
Right, of course they were.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
So where are they having to build new gas pipelines to accommodate this plant, and if they already done that, and then mm-hmm. would this gas be coming from the Dakotas or?
Yeah, most of it comes from BC and Alberta, is my understanding. Puget Sound Energy's position is we buy gas, and we know that some of it happens to be a lot of it happens to be fracked, and that's not our fault.
Ooh,
there's a lot there. They did have to build some new pipelines actually through the Puyallup Tribe's reservation to get to the plant, even though the plant technically isn't on the reservation. And there was a lot of tribal activists that came out and were like, what do you mean you're building this pipeline through our reservation? And it had to do with permits and the fact they were like, well, we have all of our permits. It ended up happening. That pipe has been laid, but there's a lot of existing gas infrastructure that Puget Sound Energy operates. Yeah. Yeah, Jesse.
Well, it's interesting because of all the projects that we've stopped, only one, the coal plant, actually existed. I mean, they were all proposed. So I'm worried that the permit that is, you know, the second round of appeal, the fact that the plant is built is going to be a factor. So
yeah.
I guess I have two questions about that. One is, if they do give the permit, where does the appeal go from there? Does it ultimately go to the U.S. Supreme Court? And how does it play in that it's been built? Because then the equities are, you know,
mm-hmm. Like on paper, it shouldn't matter,
right.
The legal argument
of
that
course.
It's built, but our experience tells us that that's not true.
Right.
And that, you know, Puget Sound Energy has already invested a ton of money in this. They already want to expand, as the rumors we're hearing, in another campaign involved with land use in Tacoma. If anyone lives in Tacoma, I would love to chat more about that. If the appeal is denied, I don't talk to the lawyers, and I'm not a lawyer. I imagine that they will probably appeal to a higher court. I'm not clear which court that is, but it could continue up. I'll also say there's a separate lawsuit that was just filed last week, actually, by some other environmental groups on the way these clean air permits are issued throughout the state. That's another thing that could potentially come into play that could affect Tacoma LNG, but that's very early in the process in the legal process. We're all just waiting on pins and needles for the decision to drop. Okay. Always happy to talk more about Tacoma LNG, but I want to make sure we also get to our other campaigns.
Thanks, Maddie. Yeah, that is one that can really get you fired up. So please do reach out if you want to get engaged further, even if you don't live in Tacoma.
Oh, I forgot to say one thing. Can I say one?
Oh, yeah.
I was trying to put out what's called a photo petition, which are folks familiar with that idea? So it's where you like hold a sign that says something, or you write a sign that says something, and we take a picture of you. And it's like a really cool visual way to show resistance to this project. I'm planning to try to print those out here, have them available maybe outside tonight if you'd like to come find me and take a picture. We have a whole album of these that we've posted on our Facebook from faith communities around the state and even across the nation when people hear about this. And if we also, Jess, can you pass around our sign up? We also are going to send a follow-up email to everyone who attended our workshops here, and we can include that photo petition instructions if you want to share it with your congregation or faith community. It's a really cool visual thing. Yes.
Great. Okay, so we've got two more that we're going to touch on. I think we'll go into not quite as much detail here because I want to get you a little bit of time to practice storytelling around these campaigns. So I'm going to keep it brief while, you know, giving a disclaimer that these are complicated issues and we do teach hour-long workshops on them and would be happy to talk in more detail to your community or to you individually some other time than now. So with that, we are currently partnering with the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition to support the Nimiqua's efforts to restore a free-flowing Lower Snake River. So anyone from the southeastern part of Washington State? Even today? Not today? Okay. If you bring up this conversation anywhere east of the Cascades, you will immediately see people put on armor and build their brick walls right up. It is incredibly contentious and has become kind of a political divide. What we're talking about is essentially removal of four outdated dams on the Lower Snake River. So these dams are not a huge source of hydroelectric power. That's more the Upper Columbia dams, and we're not talking about those right now. These dams essentially create slack water reservoirs that are have turned Lewiston, Clarkston, Idaho into an inland port. Right? So this area in the corner of Washington and Idaho, in the middle of a landlocked area, right, is a port because of how these dams have backed up the water, made it slow, so barges slowly go along the river and have for some time, so it's become the way that grain gets to market, etc. We can work on that, right? We can figure out other ways to move our products, our great agricultural products of Washington, which we're proud of and want to support, can be moved by upgraded rail infrastructure, etc. But it is, you know, one of those things, again, that the misinformation campaign around is so pervasive. So for us, our role in this conversation about dam removal is to kind of be a mediating presence and to ensure that first and foremost, we are respecting and doing better at responding to our treaty promises, and then ensuring that all of the stakeholders are kept whole through the future of what the river looks like. So we have held a series of events called Loaves and Fishes that are spaces for this dialogue, which is really, like I said, can be really fiery. So holding this space for common ground, for values-based discussion, to hear from tribal leaders, farmers, fishermen, both sport and commercial, about what each community really needs from the river to be sustained, and the ways that we can help create these win-win solutions together. It is really crucial for salmon recovery that these dams come out. And you know, salmon recovery, we might be a little bit far too down that sinking ship, but this would give the salmon their best chance at recovering. Juvenile salmon are having to stretch out their journey from when they're born to when they get to the ocean. And salmon do this amazing thing where they turn from freshwater fish to saltwater fish, right? And that's meant to take us an amount of time, but given that it's slack water and they're not able to be kind of supported down, that journey is being stretched out to much longer than that biological transformation. So that's one of the issues, along with the, you know, what you think of with dams, with the issue of salmon getting back upstream. Slow water is also incredibly warm. So this is a climate-related campaign as well, because as our water's warm, salmon can't survive in hot water. And it's a very delicate, like, switch. I think it's like 72, I don't remember actually the degrees, so don't quote me on that. But like a 1 degree difference can totally wipe out salmon. Actually, in my hometown of Sacramento, there are salmon in that river, and they're saying this year, because of the heat, there won't be any salmon that survive. I know. So, luckily we have some surprising leadership that has stepped forward on this campaign in the Congressman Simpson, who is a Republican from Idaho, has proposed a comprehensive infrastructure package that does include bringing down the dams. I should also say, when we're talking about this, these dams were made to come down. So they're not like, when you think of dam removal and you think of like dynamite and concrete, it's not that. Like, there's an earthen burn, which is just like earth and rocks piled up that just has to be removed. So they were built with this in mind. So anyways, he has included dam removal in a proposal. It has not gotten as much support as we would like to have seen. Washington's congressional delegation has not gotten behind it, neither has our governor, which was a bit of a surprise, but they are saying we need to really continue on this conversation, which is, you know, the most that Senator Campbell has chimed in to date on this, was in response to Governor Simpson, or to Congressman Simpson's proposal. So, all to say, it's a really prominent in conversation right now, especially with the infrastructure package and whatnot in Congress. There will be more stakeholder conversations coming up, which is something that we have already done, but now they're talking about doing it more as a four-state process with all the Northwest states. So there will be continuing conversation here, and it's really important for us to show up and say, like, we don't have time. We need to accelerate this process. We need to see this as, first and foremost, a treaty rights violation. So there will be opportunities, if you stay in touch with Earth Ministry, to engage in this ongoing conversation. We have some webinars on our website about it, so if you want to learn more and also hear kind of more of the theological grounding for this issue, we did one with a Lutheran pastor that is really great, and then another with one of our board members who is a river guy out of Eastern Washington. So I think that, and I'll also add that the tribes just recently had a really historic summit that was a government-to-government process, so we weren't there because it was not for us, but it is something that we amplified. There's live stream recording of it available to the public, and it was really a unification of tribes from all across the state chiming in on this issue, which is really important in terms of building the movement.
Well, and there's a precedent of the Elwha Dam coming out.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's
my husband was working at Friends of the Earth on that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yes, so the Elwha Dam is an awesome success story. And I think it's really important for us to remember those success stories. You know, I often fall into the trap of going right onto the next campaign because there's so much to do. But the Elwha Dam is one that came out in the on the Olympic Peninsula, and the recovery rate has been astounding. Yeah. Salmon and river renewal has really been impressive. And that was much more of a process of dam. That was a blow it up dynamite type dam.
Yeah.
The river.
Yeah. And it was 120 years old.
Yeah.
They've been there much longer than that.
Yeah. It hadn't been productive for electricity for a while, as I understand it.
And yeah. The other thing that I'll share in terms of a success story that's really beautiful is, shout out to Jesse Dye, who is my SAGE mentor in the room and was formerly in this position. Back in the day, Earth Ministry was really central in the conversation around shutting down Washington's last coal plant, the Centralia TransAlta plant. And part of our role is very similar to this work we're doing around the Lower Snake River, because it really was mediating a conversation about how we're not gonna leave behind the folks in this community who do work at the plant, etc. So that happened. It is being phased out, and actually phased out earlier than anticipated, and now being transitioned into Washington State's largest solar farm, which is so beautiful, right? And so there's that bringing along effort of job retraining, of clean job growth in the area, and that's the kind of conversations and imagining we want to see in Southeast Washington, in the Inland Northwest, and the bringing everybody into a more prosperous future.
Yeah, I'll just add that if you want to learn more about the folks leading, the indigenous folks leading this fight, we work with a group called Nimiqua Protecting the Environment. Nimiqua is the Nez Perce tribe's word for themselves. It's spelled N-I-M-I-I-P-U-U. And they have a website and a Facebook page, and they do a lot on the Lower Snake River salmon dam stuff.
Okay. Maddie, you want to do the quick lowdown on PFAS?
Yeah, I'm always happy to talk more about PFAS because it is sort of a wonky topic, which is a passion of mine because I studied chemistry in college, so it really fits in. This is the only place I use my chemistry degree is in our PFAS advocacy. As Jeff shared a little bit about what PFAS chemicals are, they have really amazing nonstick properties, which is why they've been used for so long in our products, etc. We do a lot of work around PFAS in many different campaigns, etc. It really just depends depends on the time of year and what's happening. Like, for example, we just had a big win in getting PFAS out of food packaging in our state faster.
Sorry, is it P-F-A?
P-F-A-S.
Okay.
Yes. If that's confusing, always happy to talk more at lunch or something about it. So we had that. It's been in food packaging because of its non-stick or grease-resistant properties a lot of times. But they also cause a lot of health problems and pollute our water and last forever because they don't break down. So there's all people are waiting. That's cute. So really briefly, we just had a win in that campaign that sped up the process to get PFAS out of food packaging in our state by 6 months. It's been sort of a long, this bill was passed a couple years ago. It's been sort of a long process to implement it. And so that's something the Earth Ministry community was really the only folks that engaged on this issue. And we're trying to celebrate our wins when we get them, since so much of our work is, oh my gosh, this thing just happened, we have to address it, et cetera. Coming up, actually, this month, until the beginning of September, there's going to be a comment period for the Department of Health, in coordination with the Department of Ecology, is setting standards for PFAS in drinking water in our state. PFAS is an issue in polluting certain communities in our state, their drinking water. Issaquah has had issues with PFAS in their drinking water. That's fixed right now, is my understanding. Whidbey has had pollution from PFAS in drinking water, and the main source, since we don't manufacture these chemicals in our state, the main source of them is through firefighting foam, yeah, which has had PFAS in it for many, many years. That is now banned in our state, firefighting foam with PFAS in it, but because those chemicals last for so long, they're still affecting a lot of communities today. There's a couple other areas throughout the state, happy to talk more, but the EPA doesn't have a national limit set for like a standard for PFAS in drinking water like they do for many other pollutants. I saw an article the other day that they're briefly considering starting that process. I think it's going to take a really long time, so our state is taking the action for that. So we're going to we'll let you all know about how you can provide input for that really important process that unfortunately was delayed a lot because of COVID, which makes sense because the Department of Health was dealing with COVID and still is dealing with COVID. And we're really grateful for their work on that. But we're also really excited to work on getting PFAS out of drinking water.
Congratulations on your win.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Happy to talk more about that later. You can also learn more on our website, and we'll send you some info. Yeah, really quick,
Justin. Yeah, just quickly, tell us why PFAS are bad. What do they do?
They have been shown to cause health problems and some certain types of cancers. I think a lot of it is still unknown what the big effects of it are, because industry has resisted study for so long, but it definitely has been conclusively linked to several cancers and other health problems. Yeah, it's not great.
Okay, whew. So we threw a lot of info at you. Please remember that you don't have to know all of the details to speak up on any of this campaign. So you can say, PFAS are toxic, Lower Snake River dams aren't needed, EV vehicles are possible, and that's what we want our future to look like. And fracked gas is real bad and not aligned with treaty promises. You know, basic takeaways that we hope you carry forward. And we hope you stay connected with us at Earth Ministry, because my joy is really making it easy for you to participate in these campaigns and to do so, again, explicitly as a person of faith. So we do have our handouts from yesterday's advocacy training, in which we got more into how to go about that. So please come and actually I'm gonna just hand it around for those of you that weren't here yesterday to get to take one. this handout really breaks down how you can lay out your story to share as a public comment, written as testimony, when you're just talking to someone at the lunch table today, right? Like we were talking about with Tacoma LNG, the court of public opinion really matters, which is just like public awareness, right? If a lot of people are fired up about PFAS, which is more and more a thing, it's been getting a lot of press coverage lately, then companies like Costco, like McDonald's, like Whole Foods are saying like, oh, we will stop having PFAS in our stores, right? Because they're hearing from their customers who are incredibly concerned about the level of use of these toxins. So advocacy can happen on all levels, interpersonal to the official pathways. And we want to help that be approachable for you. Let's see, any last questions before we wrap up? I have a nice reading to send us out.
I just had a quick question on the Snake River Dam. Do you know if there is sufficient existing, or I guess not sufficient, but existing rest infrastructure in place to replace the ocean freight, or does it just need upgrading?
I think it needs upgrading for increased capacity, but honestly, from what I've been hearing, it's like the barges are rarely used. Like it's kind of a myth that everything goes on barge anymore. Honestly, because these dams are so outdated, like when I was in the region right before the pandemic, one of the dams was like broken, and so they couldn't get barges through anyways. So since they're so old, and it would be taxpayer money used to update them, which is a whole nother pickle.
They're federally operated, which means it takes an act of Congress to do things with them.
Yeah,
the state has tried to regulate. The Department of Ecology has tried to regulate the water temperature, hotter water temperatures caused by the dams, and so there's been some federal versus state authority issues there, but even though those three dams are located within our state, the state doesn't really have a say.
So when I'd imagine that as y'all were petitioning the state government, so you're actually petitioning the federal government for the dams to come down then?
We're really asking the Northwest delegation in Congress to be leaders on this. Representative Mike Simpson from Idaho is the person that's really leading on this. Because Salmon and Idaho are affected by these dams that are in Washington, and he has a pretty good relationship with the Nimiku tribe, Nez Perce tribe, and the Washington delegation really needs to step it up.
Even the sport fishermen that we have.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
There is some tourist industry involved in it too, because there's a cruise ship that runs from there all the way down to the end of the Columbia there.
Yeah, so there's tourist industry that goes both ways though, right? Because there are also sports, I don't know what the term is, whitewater raft, you could have so much more river activities if it was more than just a big pool. Okay, well, we want to honor your time. We're happy to stick around to answer more questions one-to-one. And if you haven't already, please sign our petition to the governor, if you live in Washington. I apologize, it's a Washington-focused campaign, there are opportunities through our industry for federal action as well.
Yeah, we'll put our petition over here, Jess, is that cool?
Yeah. And to close us, I am going to share a reading from this book called Ordinary Blessings by Meta Herrick-Carlson. This is a blessing for rising. Denali's ancient and rugged rock is pinched between tectonic plates, still shifting and shaking all the time. She is rock, lava, ocean, glacier, wind, sky. She is pressure, mystery, wisdom, fortitude, caught in creation and will never tire of being made new. She is fierce and holy, her roots uncontrollable magic, her crown revealed on her own terms, responsible for the weather swirling up from her hips. Whenever the earth shakes and the ice cracks, we remember she grows taller still, 1 millimeter at a time, stealthy and sure. She is both trapped and free. She is not finished rising, and neither am I. Amen. Let us continue rising together. Thank you for being part of this community. And I'll just end by saying, you know, we talked about a lot of heavy campaign things. I hope you heard also the good stuff in there, right? And that's what we carry forth, especially as people of faith, is that hope, hope-filled vision for what we can create together.
Thank you.